When John Kennedy and Richard Nixon debated in the 1960 presidential campaign, it brought the political debate back to a prominence largely missing since Abraham Lincoln and Stephen Douglas squared off a century earlier in their Senate race. The subject of the importance and influence of presidential debates has itself been debated. We thought that following last night's Clinton-Trump confrontation and before their next meeting at Washington University, we'd look at the presidential debates in their historical context. Joining me is Peter Kaster, a professor of history at Washington University. Peter, nice to have you back with us.
Well, it's great to be here.
Well, 100 million people watched last night. I assume you were one of them. How do you think last night's debate may fit in historically with those of the past couple of decades?
So the real question people ask about debates is, do they have an impact on the outcome of an election?
Yeah.
And people who study that really argue about it. There are a lot of people who say that they don't matter all that much. Some people say that they do. We always like to think that they do. But one thing people have found is that when debates seem to have an impact on the final outcome of an election, it is when that election is close. So the 1960 election, mm-hmm. the 2000 election. And so this actually might be a debate series that matters because there also are a fair number of voters who don't seem to have aligned fully with either candidate. So these debates may matter. Mm-hmm. In many cases, they haven't, though.
The figures that I've seen is the debates may be able to shift votes by 2 to 3%, which doesn't seem like much. But as you say, in a close election, it can be determinative.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's where this election looks to be heading. And it's where those other elections were. And it so happened that those close elections also coincided with debates that had important moments in them that seemed to affect people's opinions.
Can you think of any debate of going back to 1960, that did influence and determine an election?
The two debates that people talk about, first of all, is the 1960 debate.
Right.
And for several reasons.
Nixon-Kennedy.
Nixon-Kennedy. Let's, of course, remind that for people who aren't familiar with it. And so people know that. And in fact, the students I teach have always heard that story, that the 1960 debate had an impact. It may have helped to determine the election, and it was such a close election. But the really interesting case, I think, is the 2000 debates, Gore versus George W. Bush, where and I think there already are a lot of comparisons between this election, this debate, last night's debate, and those debates, not simply because they were important because one candidate seemed people thought that George W. Bush wouldn't do well. He actually did well. But also that Al Gore had prepared for that debate in a way that was supposed to prevent him from not only to accentuate his strengths but prevent him from doing certain things that he did when he spoke that would accentuate his negatives. And he did exactly those things, his tendency to sigh and seem dismissive of George W. Bush. And in the run-up to this debate, a lot of people were wondering, would Donald Trump do those things that he does and things that a lot of people were saying he shouldn't do that would work against him?
And he did both. There were two Donald Trumps that showed up last night at various parts of the debate. And that's what Hillary Clinton had to prepare for, was which Trump is going to show up.
She got them both. She got one Trump for about 25 minutes, and then she got another Trump for about an hour.
Was there a moment or were there moments last night that you saw that might, stay with us for a good and long time to come?
People are already thinking about this.
What's
the moment that people are going to talk about? And we can guess about it now, but it's going to be entirely determined by the outcome of the election. Because one of the problems with debates is that our memory of them historically is refracted through the outcome of the election. The election goes one way. We look at the debate and we say, here's where we could see the election going in a certain direction. The 92 debate's a great example of that, where Bill Clinton seemed to be highly effective in the debate structure and then he defeats George H.W. Bush. People are suggesting different ones. The line that's stuck with me the most was Hillary Clinton saying of Donald Trump, "You're in your own reality, Donald." Uh-huh. And it was so short. It was so powerfully delivered. If she wins, that may well be the phrase that is used to frame this entire election sequence. And it may wind up alongside Ronald Reagan's "There You Go Again" comments, similar comments that seem off the cuff and that are about the other candidate.
We have a clip of a couple of those moments.
Oh, that'd
anyway,
be great. Let's...
One is of Gerald Ford in 1976. That'll mm-hmm. be the first one we hear. They're all together. Then Ronald Reagan in 1984. And then my favorite, Lloyd Benson and
Lloyd
Dan
Benson.
Quinn in 1988. Let's listen to those three clips.
There is no Soviet domination of Eastern Europe, and there never will be under a Ford administration.
I will not make age an issue of this campaign. I am not going to exploit, for political purposes, my opponent's youth and inexperience.
I have as much experience in the Congress as Jack Kennedy did when he sought the presidency.
Senator, I served with Jack Kennedy. I knew Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy was a friend of mine. Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy.
You know, you have the same reaction I did. I have the same reaction hearing that right now that I had when I heard it the first time. An utterly devastating moment.
Absolutely. And I actually come out of these always with extraordinary admiration for all of the candidates because there's no room for error. They make mistakes and they're dealing with people who are very nimble and capitalizing on them. What's really interesting about that Ford comment, which I think says a lot about debates, is that echoed and that became the phrase that people used to try to explain Ford. But at the time when they surveyed people who had watched the debate, that moment hadn't really resonated with them. That wasn't the defining moment of the debate, but it came to define Ford, and both before and after the election. And the thing I often think of is almost immediately after this, Saturday Night Live did a takeoff of that debate. And Chevy Chase's Gerald Ford walks out to the podium with a hypodermic needle sticking out of his arm. They never explain it. They don't say why it's there. He didn't look anything like Ford, but it was – those two were combined to convey the notion that Ford was some kind of bumbling fool. But when people listened to that debate, they didn't react that way. Mm-hmm. And if you watch that debate now, it seems – both candidates seem, especially compared to last night, so serious, so detail-oriented, so – knowledgeable about policy.
It was Jimmy Carter, by the way.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Jimmy Carter, Gerald Ford.
That the two of them together, that it seems like a debate from a completely different era.
Ford did go on to lose that election.
He did.
Interestingly, Lloyd Benson was not a winner in that election.
No, he was not.
This was, of course, a vice presidential debate. Ronald Reagan, as we all know, did go on to win. Mm-hmm. What about the punditry that follows these debates? It seems to me that a lot of people, just as you indicated with Gerald Ford, people didn't get it when he actually said it. But people make their determination based upon what's said following the debate by the pundits.
Exactly. What the echo chamber is that surrounds this. This is actually one of the questions I put to my students, which is, what did you do after the debate? Did you watch commentary on television? Did you check Facebook? I don't know if they use because they're younger than me. Did they look on Twitter? Do they look somewhere else for the commentary on this? And I think people are finally starting to pay attention to that because one of the limitations of these attempts to understand the impact of debates is they tend to focus on what people say about the debate, not the way the debate continues to echo and continue to shape how they understand things. Because even though Lloyd Benson delivered that line and Dukakis Benson lost, it had this huge impact on Dan Quayle. That's the way he was framed throughout the entirety of George H.W. Bush's administration. Mm-hmm. And we're slowly getting a sense of how that commentary continues to frame the election long afterwards.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that one of your colleagues academic world has written a book about the vice presidency, mm-hmm. and it surprised me, and I'm having a brain cramp on the name, and I shouldn't.
Okay.
But he pointed out that Dan Quayle was actually one of the better vice presidents that we've had, that he was because of an incident like this and because of misspelling potato or tomato, whatever it was, potato, that he got this bad rap, and he was actually very effective as a vice president.
Exactly, that he did a lot. And he's this transitional role in the vice presidency, that he was supportive of his president, but he tried to take a policy role for himself. But he was branded a lightweight at that moment. It had already been happening, but it was confirmed in the debate and in the weeks that followed. I think, you know, Doonesbury would always have some – wouldn't show the president but would have some symbol for the president. I think I may be wrong. I think his might have been a feather, that he was a lightweight.
Yeah. Joel Goldstein is the author. And I forgive me, Joel, for having not being able to remember your name. It's a wonderful book, by the way.
Absolutely.
I absolutely
terrifically knowledgeable.
It. The format for the next debate is going to be somewhat different. It's going to be a town hall as opposed to the podium setting that they had last night. Make a difference? This has happened in the past. How do you see that?
I think this is actually going to be a bigger test of these two candidates because it doesn't play to either of their strengths. The candidates who've most effectively used the town hall structure are those who are able to easily connect with individuals on a one-to-one basis. You know, Bill Clinton is described as the master of that. He's the one who did it most effectively. But the other thing that I think is really at stake in this is, does the town hall format really offer anything? When the town hall structure was rolled out in 92, the claim was that this would give more direct access from average citizens to the candidates, and it would, to some degree, replace the role of journalists who were asking the questions, and that somehow the candidates would be more accountable. I mean, that's what we all assume it's supposed to do. But I've been watching these town hall debates, the old ones, and what is striking is the degree to which increasingly over time the candidates do to the people asking the questions exactly what they've increasingly done to the moderators, which is to try to make an end run around them. Ignore the question, pivot back to the points that they want to make. That's particularly clear in the 2008 town hall debate, where both Obama and McCain were incredibly polite, really connected with these people asking questions, and completely ignored their questions, and then went on to make their points.
Politicians do have a tendency sometimes to not answer.
Absolutely.
Questions. You know, a lot of people, a lot that I've read today from, again, the pundits and the columnists and what have you, they seem to be fairly unanimous in saying that Donald Trump did not have the debate he might have wanted last night, that Hillary Clinton probably won it. We should point out that when President Obama debated Mitt Romney, their first debate, Romney clobbered Obama.
Absolutely. And Obama was playing catch-up from a debate sense after that. And again, it shows that debates alone don't seem to determine the outcome of elections. But what was interesting about that, and this again gets to what people are looking for in debates. They want, at one moment, one of the functions of presidential debates is for the candidates, in theory, to give detailed information about what they're going to do as president. It's also supposed to give the people watching or listening to it some glimpse of who this person is. It's supposed to give them access to them in a way they don't get in any other format. And that was what was so strange about the 2012 debate, that it seemed like this was a completely different Obama, because the sense of Obama from debates was that, you know, whether he won or lost, it was that he was always in that debate, that he was always incisive, that he was always there. And after that debate, it wasn't just that people said that Romney had won. People wondered, who's this guy who showed up? I mean, that doesn't seem to be the Obama who we knew, whether you supported him or not.
I wonder if there is any point at all, Peter, to a vice presidential debate. That, you know, it's interesting. Certainly the one in 2008 with Sarah Palin and Joe Biden was an interesting debate. But it's probably not going to influence an election. That's my take on it.
I agree. Yeah. But I find anything that enables people to get more information and greater access to candidates is important and useful. You know, Steve Givens was on earlier talking about that debate. What was really interesting about the 2008 debate wasn't just the attention that it brought, But the number of journalists from overseas was really striking. And these people were fascinated in part by the whole election because they were interested in Obama. But Sarah Palin fascinated them. The other thing that the vice presidential debates do, if the candidates do things effectively, is it enables them to sharpen the claims about the candidates. It's not about themselves. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be about the presidential candidates who they're running with. The vice presidential debates don't. They were an experiment of sorts, like the town hall structure. And what they've ended up being is simply a slightly different version of the more traditional podium-style debate. Mm-hmm.
You know, I wonder. You mentioned Saturday Night Live a moment or two ago, and I wonder which might have more influence on an election. Tina Fey, if you will, Saturday Night Live and the kinds of things that they've done over the years with Dana Carvey as George Bush, or the debates themselves. What do you think?
I'm thinking about this. Yeah. We don't know,
yeah.
Which is actually my way of saying I think that Saturday Night Live, which is at least an easy thing to measure. It's a TV show. You can find out how many people watch it. You can find out how often the YouTube clips have been watched. That has an impact. The great unknown is how the chatter going on in newer media forms, in social media, in other forms of electronic communication, what impact those are having. It doesn't mean the debates don't matter. They're the ones that spark that debate. The problem is, and this is what drives social scientists nuts, is you can't easily measure and quantify those ripple effects that come from those. But I absolutely agree with you. That has a huge impact. All that ancillary discussion, which may not be the candidate speaking, it may not be serious journalism, but it frames how Americans think about these people.
On the other hand, on the other side, it also draws people, perhaps their interest into the election itself, because they're having this experience on Saturday nights and become more interested in the election as a result
Absolutely.
Of it.
This was the big question about The Daily Show, when it became clear that there were a large number of people, mostly young people, who were for whom The Daily Show was a principal source of news for them. Yeah. And there are two ways to read that. Yeah. And I had students for whom that was the case.
Of course.
And in some ways I thought this is wonderful. We always want students to be learning about the news, but also having them understand that it's such a skewed sense of it, because Jon Stewart was the first to admit. He said, I am not a news journalist. I talk about the news, but that's not what I do.
Yeah.
And it's hard to know whether the glass is half full or half empty.
You mentioned social media a couple of moments ago, and here again, we had talked about the pundits and following the debate and the discussion. Now the debate is taking place, or the discussion is taking place during the debate.
Right.
With Twitter and Facebook, people are commenting and coming up with their conclusion as to who won or lost before it's even over.
Well, and that's the other important thing to understand about the debates and seeing them in their history. If you think about the debates from not just the 1960 Kennedy-Nixon debate, but then beginning again in 1976 and into the 1980s, the way those debates ran was there was a moderator and there were always several journalists sitting at the table. And they had this real authority. The candidates responded to them. They were the ones asking the questions. And the big change in these debates, probably since 2008, has been to watch that structure come apart. The first thing that happened is we've moved now to one moderator who asks the questions rather than a panel of people asking the questions.
There are going to be two in the next one, though.
There will be two, yeah, exactly. There'll be two of them. But you would have three or four people sitting at a desk and they'd ask their questions. So we've moved away from that. The candidates are more aggressively ignoring their questions. And in the meantime, the number, what makes somebody a pundit is far more vague now. Is it somebody who works in a completely different job, but whose tweets or postings or whatever have a wide readership? Is that person now a pundit who is a significant part of the analysis of the debate? That's the question people are wondering about now.
And of course, with the cable TV influence now. There are right. many more pundits than there ever have been before.
Exactly.
There was a question I meant to ask of Steve earlier in the segment, and I was watching one of the channels last night, and the John Podesta, who is the Hillary Clinton campaign guy, said that he didn't think there was going to be a second debate. He thought that, in fact, that Mr. Trump would decide against further debates. That remains to be seen. But is there any kind of a historical precedence for that, for bailing out?
There's no historical precedent for Donald Trump. Yeah. And I've given up on people tried to predict not only what would become of his candidacy, but what he would do. There isn't one exactly like that I can. There probably is something I'm forgetting. I wouldn't be surprised if a caller calls in who knows the details of a situation like that. But there has not been a candidate like him or one who has interacted with the debate system the way that he did, a candidate who goes on and yells in a presidential debate. That what we saw last night was unique.
Is there a debate that you can look to, and we just have a few seconds left in the past, that was the best debate, the most effective debate, the most effective participants?
The most effective?
Yeah.
Because there were some debates that were, and I actually think that 1976 Ford-Carter debate, as a historian, as someone who likes politics, that was the one that may have come closest to the vision of what the debate would be, which is that a set of very well-informed, very serious journalists asked serious, detailed questions, and the candidates actually responded to those questions in detail and behaved in a civil manner towards each other. So it's not the debate that had the biggest impact on the outcome of the election, but it may have been the one that came closest to doing, I think, what the people who planned the debates imagined they might be.
All right. Well, we have several more to look at. Peter Castor, thank you for being with us of Washington University. Pleasure to see you again. Thanks for being with us.
Pleasure to be here.
Tomorrow on this program, we have lots going on. Among the things we'll be talking about is with Dorit Buscarin, our reporter here at St. Louis Public Radio. She's in Uganda. We'll hear a report from her. Archive versions, past St. Louis On the Air programs, available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.